Common sense is something that seems like it needs no explanation. But where does this kind of intelligence come from and what influences it? We're taking a look at common sense for today's Please Explain. Duncan J. Watts, sociologist and principal researcher at Yahoo, joins us. He's the author of Everything is Obvious Once You Know the Answer, How Common Sense Fails Us, published by Crown. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
And we're also taking your calls. If you have a question, you can reach us at 646-829-3985 or leave a comment on the show page, WNYC.org. The number again, 646-829-3985. So common sense does seem to need no explanation, and yet there's this really good and well-written book that does try to explain it. So let's start with the definition. That's kind of hard. What do we mean when we say common sense?
Well, see, it's a very interesting question, Mike, because it's a question that everybody thinks they can answer, and yet everybody gives a different answer. And whenever that happens, it should worry you. So, you know, everybody thinks they know what common sense is. They think they know how to define it. They think they recognize it when they see it. And yet, when you ask people to do all these things, you know, they give answers that are very confident, that seem to them completely self-evident. And yet you find that people define it in all sorts of different ways. And people disagree often, you know, vehemently about matters of common sense. And if you look at the way that the word is used in political rhetoric, you know, you see our leaders sort of referring to sort of common sense solutions all the time. But when they use the same words to describe solutions that are completely at odds with each other. And so, you know, this is, you know, a problem that in some sense should be obvious. And the reason really is that, you know, common sense is not actually well defined. And it's a kind of knowledge that's very different from the sorts of the other kinds of knowledge that we have, like scientific knowledge.
It's maybe easy to define by what it's not. It's the kind of knowledge that's hard to write down in a computer program. Like you talk about the example of if you try to write a code telling a computer how to clean a room, which anyone could clean a room by using common sense. It's very hard to tell a computer, you know, not to throw away the trash and not to throw away the bed.
That's right. So common sense, and the way I think about common sense is sort of really what it does. And what it does is it helps us. It's the kind of intelligence that helps people navigate everyday social situations. And so, you know, whenever you are, you know, when you live in a big city like New York, just sort of walking around the streets or using public transport involves like all kinds of rules and about what's polite and what's, you know, necessary and you know, what's an acceptable way to behave and how close you can stand to someone on a subway car depending on how crowded it is and, you know, how to sort of, you know, make eye contact or not make eye contact. I mean, there's all these very kind of fine context-dependent rules that we sort of implicitly follow that help us to, you know, learn, you know how to dress, how to behave, how to speak, you know, how to sort of, you know, transact with one another. You know, if you actually tried to write down all of these rules and teach them to an artificial intelligence, you would realize just how wildly complex it is. So it, in some sense, common sense is a remarkable piece of human intelligence. But at the same time, this sort of inability that we have to actually really define it causes all sorts of problems.
And it's also very culturally dependent. As another experiment you talk about, two people are asked to share $100. One person gets to make the split and the other person gets to say, I'll take it or I'll reject it. Now, an economist would say if you split it $99 to one, the person should just take the one because it didn't have a dollar. But in fact, at least here in America, any split beyond something like 30-70 is almost always rejected. But in other cultures, there are widely different examples of what is almost always accepted and what is almost always rejected.
That's right. I mean, so this is called the ultimatum game, and it's something that economists find fascinating because the way that real people play it, it varies quite dramatically from sort of predictions of economic rationality and you know, when the game is played, as it has been hundreds of times in Western cultures. You sort of get these very, very strong norms of fairness that come into play. Where so typically, if I'm the person who gets to make the offer, I'll offer a 50-50 split. And if you're deciding whether or not to accept it, you won't take anything less than a third. So, you know, you'll walk away from $30 just to punish me for being a jerk, right? And so this is something, again, that, you know, in Western society, we think, oh, yeah, of course that's what people do. Like, that's common sense,
that's
which,
common
of course,
sense,
is what
yeah.
it is. But then when anthropologists did this study in other kinds of pre-industrial cultures around the world, in tribes in Papua New Guinea and in South America, they actually found quite different answers depending on other sorts of cultural norms that those people have. So, you know, and so in Papua New Guinea, they actually reject even 50-50 offers because in their culture, gifts come with an expectation of future reciprocation.
Right. So it's not generosity to them. It's an obligation.
So they're thinking, oh, I don't want this, you know, because I'm going to have to do something for you in the future. And so, you know, and of course, once you understand that rule, then it also seems like common sense. And in fact, it's exactly what it is to them. It's just that what is common sense depends on a whole set of other things that we're not thinking about.
Yeah. So in some ways, common sense, the best way to describe it is simple solutions. But the pejorative version of that would be lazy thinking. It's kind of both things.
Well, I think the distinction that I try to make in the book is that, you know, common sense is not good or bad.
Right.
It's good for some things and it's bad for other things. And the critical distinction to make is, you know, when is it one and when is it the other? And I think, so if you're looking for, like, when does common sense work really well, it works really well when you're actually in the situation, right, where you're there and you know everything about it and you know, you're dealing with people who are right in front of you and you can see all the details in front of you. And then you just sort of know what the right thing is to do. I mean, common sense is seems self-evident because it just comes unbidden. Like, you're, you know, people with common sense just always seem to know how to behave. People without it are always screwing up. And it's very hard to explain to them what they're doing wrong. So common sense works very well when you're really in context. Where it works poorly is when you're not in context, when you're making sort of predictions or you're trying to anticipate how people are going to behave. When they're not in front of you, when they're distant from you, when they're different from you, and when there are many of them sort of spread all over the place. And you might think, well, that's a weird thing to do. We never do that. But actually, we do that sort of thing all the time.
Whenever anyone has a solution for poverty, those usually are kind of wealthy politicians with, or even well-funded sociologists with said
That's
solution,
right.
Not someone who's living in a housing project with that solution.
Absolutely. Yeah. So any kind of politics, any kind of planning, any kind of, you know, sort of prediction about the, you know, the future, you know, what's going to happen in, you know, in Iraq or in Palestine or, you know, or in Libya. You know, any sort of even trying to design marketing campaigns or corporate strategy. I mean, these are all planning exercises that we go through all the time. And when we do that, we sort of instinctively use our common sense. We think about, well, you know, how would I behave if I were in that situation? And we try to model the behavior of other people by sort of putting ourselves into their shoes. And we do this so often and so naturally and so easily that we don't even realize exactly what it is that we're doing. But the problem is that those people are not like us. They're not right here. We don't know all the details, and so we invariably make mistakes.
My friend, who's literally a Harvard MBA, once went on this little jag telling me how he would live if he were homeless, what kind of bottles he would collect and repeat. The point is that they're not Harvard MBAs, you know? You can't know you're not in their position. Hey, a question for our listeners. Call where common sense has failed you or where common sense has saved the day. Our number is 646-829-3985. Or any examples you have of common sense not being common. A couple ones that I think about are steer into the skid. That is an example of maybe counterintuitive thinking that works. And then the whole idea, this is supposedly common sense. Right now we're going through an economic recession. Now's the time that we as a government need to tighten our belts. Well, that might in fact be the worst policy. This might be the worst time to tighten our belts. Mm-hmm. But it just seems so common sense. Because of what you just said, we analogize from the position we know. Well, in my household, we don't have money. We have to stop spending. Well, guess what? If every household stops spending, it's a formula for keeping in a recession. So, yeah.
That's right. I mean, that's a great example, actually, because we do have, you know, and particularly in sort of political rhetoric, have this tendency to sort of analogize between individual personal experience or individual household experience and make sort of statements about, like, well, you know, Americans, you know, when they spend too much, they have to, you know, they don't get a blank check, you know.
My
have to
family sort of, like, has a budget.
Exactly.
Budget,
you know, I grew up on a peanut farm, and so, you know, everything I know about the government I learned by working on a peanut farm, and actually that's probably not the most useful expertise for you know, economic policy, and you know, that's why we, you know, I mean, I have many critical things to say about economists, but they actually know something about economics, and maybe, you know, we should listen to them.
Right. I think maybe even the big problem is not – I have no idea about the motivation of the politician saying it. I think perhaps even more sadly that it's not cynical, that a lot of the politicians saying it really do believe it, like my family has to stay within a budget. It's just the total failure of some other politician or some commentators in the media to make the correct point, which is that – when someone says we can't go on deficit spending forever, yeah, we probably can because we always have, except for, you know, a week of our history or whatever it is. It's that there's no receptive audience for kind of an anti-common sense solution to a lot of our hardest problems.
Yeah, so this is a very, I mean, this is sort of, in a way, the what motivated me to write this book in the first place is that, you know, my background many years ago was as a physicist, and then I, you know, I did my PhD in engineering, and then I became a sociologist and taught sociology for several years. And, you know, it sort of was interesting to me how differently people respond to scientific expertise versus expertise on things to do with people,
right?
So sociology or economics or policy or any of these things. And, you know, we have a tendency to sort of revere and respect scientific expertise. So when someone explains something to you about superconductivity, you know, you don't tell them that they're wrong, right? You don't tell them that what they're telling you is obvious, right? It seems like this is, you know, it's amazing that anyone could even understand this kind of thing. And so, you have a tendency to just believe it. You might find it uninteresting, but you're not going to question their authority. But when it comes to matters that are, you know, the sort of science of people, of course, we are people and we have all sorts of experience of being a person and living in the social world. And so we're much, much more reluctant to allow anyone to tell us that they know something about how the social world works that contradicts our own experience of it. And so
this is all encapsulated in the existence of the phrase, it's not rocket science, as you point out.
That's right.
Which is really good point.
I actually hate that phrase because we're actually pretty good at rocket science. You know, like when you point a rocket at the, you know, at Mars, it actually really goes there and very rarely does it even crash into the thing. And when it does, you know, as the NASA Mars Orbiter did a few years ago, it's tremendously embarrassing. And you know, that was a famous story because they, you know, they programmed it with the wrong units and metric instead of imperial or something. And it, you know, it sort of went into orbit a few hundred kilometers too low and so crashed instead of orbiting. Now, this was regarded as just a massive failure on the part of NASA. But if you think about it, you know, I mean, this thing went, you know, millions and millions of miles before it reached there. If we could plan the economy even, you know, like 1% as well as we can sort of plan the trajectory of an interplanetary rocket, we'd be doing great.
Or figure out the marketing budget for soap or
exactly.
Something like how do you open a movie? It's not rocket science.
That's right.
It's much, much harder.
Much harder. or whether it's harder or not, we're less good at it.
We're much less good at it. So exactly. We're speaking with Duncan Watts. His book is Everything is Obvious Once You Know the Answer. The topic is Please Explain Common Sense. And after a break, we'll be taking your calls, including we're going to learn a little bit about Japanese egg wrapping. You'll want to stick around for that, so please do. Hi, this is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate. Please Explain Common Sense. Here to do that for us is Duncan J. Watts, author of Everything is Obvious, asterisk explained, Once You Know the Answer, How Common Sense Fails Us. And our number is 646-829-3985, or you could leave comments on the show page. Tell me about some other cultures' common sense that you came across, a failure of common sense, where common sense has helped or hurt. And I think it's either, is it Edie in the
yes.
in Greenwich Village? Hello, Edie, go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
What your conversation brought up in my mind was the connection between common sense and design, especially design of everyday objects. And I thought about a classic book on traditional Japanese packaging design. It's called How to Wrap Five Eggs. And they came up with the idea of the way you wrap five eggs is to have five eggs, one on top of the other, in a little basket, each one wrapped with raffia, one on top of the other. And that obviously made perfect sense. It was a vertical thing hanging down, sort of looks like a little bird feeder almost. And that's how the eggs are wrapped.
Right.
And I also thought of, like, who decides, what height a common toilet seat should be, you know? You know, the everyday intersection of, quote, common sense and design.
Right. And another example of this, and this is one that people point out makes no common sense, is you go through a drive-through ATM and the numbers are in Braille. But sometimes there are considerations beyond, like, it does make more common sense to just not have whatever machine makes up those numbers, to not have one setting without the Braille, so they all have Braille on it. But, you know, in this interconnected world, I think maybe one of the promises was that common sense, or at least simple, good solutions, were supposed to get better, and that doesn't always work.
No, I think that that under many circumstances, that's exactly where we get into trouble, is that, you know, we common sense, again, works very well for us in ordinary, everyday situations. And because it works so well, we have this tremendous faith in it. And so we want to use it to solve all kinds of problems that have to do with human behavior. And that's actually not necessarily true.
One, you know, we talked about steering into a skid and spending out of recession and the things that politicians say. The other side of that coin is how people themselves vote. You talk about this, and I have some thoughts, but your point of view is people generally vote based on what they call common sense, but it really doesn't fit with your definition of common sense.
Well, so an interesting, you know, when people think about their sort of political beliefs, I mean, we have this sort of impression that they come from some sort of overarching philosophy. And, you know, and I think that we think this because that's how things work in other areas of science. We have some sort of general theory, and that general theory can be used to sort of derive everything else. But when, you know, when political scientists sort of look at people's actual views, they're really sort of all over the place. So just, you know, knowing that someone, you know, we have the impression that, you know, all Republicans think the same thing and all Democrats think the same thing. But actually, it turns out that, you know, that being a sort of Republican voter is not necessarily terribly predictive about what you think about immigration or what you think about abortion or what you think about these other kinds of issues. So our actual beliefs are sort of jumbled around, and we seem to arrive at them more or less independently. But that's certainly not how we think about our own beliefs.
I mean, we believe, probably not consciously, but we believe so much in the power of common sense and our own common sense and the wisdom of the American electorate. Oh, God. We believe in that so much that we don't go back and assess often the choices we make. And it's easy to say that for other people, why they chose wrong. But I, myself, have said on occasion, I misvoted because of mistakes I made. I like to analyze myself sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't know many people who do that. And I don't know many people who, because I, like you, I'm not a huge believer in common sense. I try to say, why did I make this mistake? I try to vote better the next time. Doesn't usually happen. Usually we blame the politicians for not living up to our expectations, as opposed to a cognitive mistake we made in casting a vote.
Well, there's another problem that you bring up here, which is that, you know, we have this sort of very kind of misleading relationship with history. So, you know, we can always sort of look back in the past, and we can, you know, that we have all sorts of biases that affect the way that we remember, you know, what we were doing and what we were thinking. So there's a well-known bias that where people sort of, when they are forced to recall their predictions about how things were going to work out in the past, they remember being sort of confident about the things that did happen and being very skeptical about the things that did not happen.
Right.
And so, you know, the problem is that when we try to explain, you know, whether people did things well or poorly, whether we did things well or poorly, we always sort of know what happened. And the fact that we know what happened causes us to mislead ourselves into thinking that we should have known what happened.
In politics, there are a couple of examples that touch on that. One is the well-known phenomenon that when they do a poll right after an election and they ask, who did you vote for? The poll will reveal the winning candidate got much more votes in the poll than he really got in real life. It's either that people like being on the right side, or they do convince themselves that they were right. They maybe have literally even forgotten. And the other thing about looking back in the past and having it being misleading, this is something that Karl Rove used to light upon, is that people like to back a winner, and they like to think that they've backed a winner. And so if you could kind of convince people this guy's winning, more people will flock to them.
Right.
People are more attracted to ideas that other people say are good.
Right. Right. So we have this... we have this tendency of what's called hindsight bias to think that we sort of knew it all along, and this kind of makes us feel that our beliefs about the world are much more accurate and predictive than they really are. And so I think, you know, one of the themes that I sort of keep coming back to over and over again is that a lot of the stuff that we care about, you know, in sort of planning and politics, is far less predictable than we would like to think it is, and we have to actually come to grips with that rather than sort of after the fact sweeping away the uncertainty in the way that we tend to do.
Right, and if there is a circumstance where a few things could have happened, whatever thing actually happened, we tend to think of it as the thing that was inevitable, the thing that was most likely, and that's far from the case. We were talking earlier with Fouad Georges about 9/11. Mm-hmm. It was a very unlikely event, I think experts now are saying. Still, we kind of look at it as this thing that was at the time likely to have happened. If we conceptualize it as this very lucky thing, maybe world history would be different.
Yeah, I mean, I would go even stronger than saying that we think it was likely to have happened. We actually have a tendency to think that what happened was inevitable.
Yeah.
Right? That you know, even if at the time we acknowledge that it seemed unlikely, you know, even if we forgive ourselves for not having predicted it, we still think, well, it was going to happen. And we know it's going to happen because it did happen. And so, you know, in some sense, this is true, but it's true in a very sort of unhelpful way, right? Because it doesn't, you know, when we try to learn from history, what we're really trying to do is learn lessons that we can apply again in the future. And so, you know, it may be true that in some sense that, you know, given where we are today, what happened in the past had to happen. But that doesn't necessarily tell us anything about what we can do better in the future. And really, that's the lesson that we should be trying to learn.
See, they're trying to amend George Santa Anna's famous statement about history is Duncan J. Watts. He is the author of Everything is Obvious, Once You Know the Answer, How Common Sense Fails Us. We're asking for your calls on common sense at 646-829-3985. Curtis from Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go right
Great
ahead.
Show. Very interesting. Nothing is less common than common sense. But an example of where common sense fails, I think, is this notion that if somebody is great at business, they're going to be great, and that's the great in government, and that's who we should have running the government. Gee, if somebody had a huge success building a business, we ought to make them mayor or you know, something else. Well, because the skills that are involved in building a business aren't the same. You know, a CEO's success in business will often be at their competitors' expense.
Right.
And they're trying to take advantage of externalities. If I'm a CEO of business, I lay off people. It's going to help my, you know, bottom line somehow. I don't have to worry what happens to those people. But if you're running the government, you're looking out for everybody. And you do have to worry about people who don't have jobs.
Right.
And your task is to, I guess, minimize externalities and not just favor one company over another, but make sure everybody's, you know, working well. So the skills, that common sense idea that, gee, if you're good at business, you're going to be a good politician, you know, I think that's an example of what you're talking about.
Thanks for the call, Curtis. Does this go to a deeper heuristic, as it would be called, the an argument by analogy fallacy?
I think that is certainly one important point that you're bringing up there, that what works in one particular situation shouldn't necessarily be assumed to work in another kind of situation, and we have this tendency to gloss over the specifics. And I think that, you know, that is a, you know, what some people call the planning fallacy, that you sort of, you know, you come in with your set of rules and you think that they work because they worked somewhere else in the past. And so therefore they should work again. You know, and we see this when, you know, economists try to design, as they did in the early 1990s for Eastern Europe, design rules for, you know, market transformation that turned out they made a whole bunch of assumptions about, you know, how markets work that really only applied in the context where the rules had been learned, and they did not apply in Eastern Europe, and so you have the, you know, sort of terrible outcome there. So I think that's absolutely true. But the other point that I think you bring up is that we really have too much reverence for success. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is an idea called the halo effect, that you know, we that the simply having succeeded casts a halo over everything else that you've done. So we have this, you know, if you look at just forget about, you know, corporate executives going from the corporate world to the public sector. Just look at, you know, corporate performance. You know, we see that companies that are doing very well are routinely described as having great leadership and visionary, you know, great vision and great execution. And companies that do poorly have the opposite description. And we assume that the causal arrow goes from like really good process to success. But actually, very often it's the case that that it's really the success that is biasing our perception of the process, right? So that when people succeed, we think, oh, they must have done something good because they succeeded, right? And so we should take that person and we should go and let them do something else. And, you know, quite possibly they were just lucky.
Yeah. Or another thing happens in, say, NFL coaching. People say, look, Bill Parcells has succeeded everywhere he went. Well, when you get to be really good at something, you could choose your situations and you choose only the good ones. And in fact, here in New York, Joe Torre is a great counterexample to, because he wasn't really successful anywhere until he got to this great situation of the Yankees. And then they won the World Series several times under him. Joseph, speaking of Joe Torre and the Yankees, is from the Bronx. Hello, Joseph.
Hi.
Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, I love this program. I was also thinking that in the private sector, when you use common sense, it's often a sort of passive-aggressive use to say to the other person, what you want to do is stupid, but you don't want to say that exactly. So you say, everybody else, you know, common sense would have it that you wouldn't do it that way. So it's a really kind of muted insult to imply common sense. And when in the public sector, if it's a politician who uses it, he's sort of saying he's going to his home base. He's saying, well, the common man uses common sense. It's only common sense that we don't agree with this policy. It's because I don't agree with it. And to imply that the average citizen would not want to go there because they have, of course, common sense, it's just a buzzword in a way.
Yeah, I think it's an important point that the way we use common sense is, you know, it's presented as not requiring any evidence, right? That when something is self-evident, you, by definition, you don't need to support it, right? But this makes common sense a very bad way of settling arguments, right? Because neither side feels that they need to provide any evidence because what they're saying is to them self-evident. And so the other person is just an idiot or evil or something. And we can demonize them. And
right, this is the point is you're either ignorant or evil because how could you not get it? And if you don't, you're stupid. And so you're probably pretending and lying.
And so the solution is to stop using that argument and say, okay, we disagree. What's the evidence?
Right.
You know, now we sort of are back in the realm of science where we can at least hope to settle our agreements, even if we disagree. Settle our disagreements, even if, you know, we begin by disagreeing, by, you know, at least agreeing on what the evidence ought to be that should settle the dispute. And if we can't even get to that stage, it's very unclear how we're going to, solve problems at all.
And Joseph, I want to thank you for the call. So if common sense is so, if has all these pitfalls and is not common and is not always sensible, how come we as a society aren't still living in mud? I mean, it's been this great driver of decisions and civilization has grown. There must be several benefits to it, or do the benefits stop at a point, plateau at a point when we get to an industrialized, advanced society?
Well, I mean, I'd say there's lots of answers to that question. You know, I think that, you know, a great deal of human progress is actually attributable to the scientific method, right? So if you think about the scientific method, what is it? Well, it's a way of learning about the world that doesn't require you to have any intuition for it. And so our technological advances have really sort of come from acknowledging the limitations of common sense. You're right, though, that you know, everything is not a total disaster. Like, sometimes we get things right. And at the end of the day, it's actually kind of, it's probably impossible to say, if we sort of applied a scientific approach to policy making, you know, would we have done better as a society than we have? I think the point that I'm trying to make is not that we should never, there are certainly plenty of circumstances where we have no choice, right? Like where we sort of, you have to kind of, as a leader, you kind of have to make the best guess that you have under, you know, that you can
Japan
with the available evidence.
Japan and, bombs Pearl Harbor. What do
you
do?
You can't sort of wait for the, you know, for the social scientists to sort of figure it all out. Now, that's not the argument I'm making. The argument I am making, though, is that there are enough examples of times when we wish we should have, when we feel like we should have been able to do better than we've done, that it's worth examining what can be done better.
Yeah. If nothing else, if, you know, your book or at least this way of thinking goes towards somewhat sullying the phrase common sense in the political context, like if a politician these days were to use the phrase right-thinking Americans, they'd be laughed at a little and it would be known a little bit as code words. Perhaps we could do that with the common sense solution refrain that we hear from politicians so much. Then again, what about the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell? Is that the opposite? His general thesis is that let's trust our gut and intuition. It's usually right.
Yep. Well, it's right until it isn't.
The answer is obvious until it isn't. And there are a lot of books. I mean, I'm attracted to these kind of books that are the sort of cavalcade of counterintuitivism. There's the Freakonomics books. There's the books by Daniel Ariely. I don't know. Maybe we could ponder on why I think the public radio audience might be into those books, but you know, in a very nutshell, in your last thesis, why does this book stand apart from all these other kind of books which just present a lot of interesting counterintuitive examples?
I think, you know, the main difference is that, you know, there are certainly a lot of books out there that that sort of go through a litany of you know biases in human thinking, you know, that we don't think the way that we think we think. I think the difference here is that I'm really concerned with not just how we think, but how we explain the world, right?
Yep.
Like, why is it that if you know, we have all these biases and there are all this sort of stuff that we know about complex systems, why do we keep thinking that common sense works?
Everything is obvious once you know the answer. Duncan J. Watts is the author. He writes about how common sense fails us, and thanks for joining in on our Please Explain segment. Thanks very much, Duncan.
Thank you, Mike.
On Monday's show, we'll speak to the lead reporters behind ProPublica's Dollars for Docs project, which investigates how much money pharmaceutical companies spend on training and influencing doctors. Then Alexandra Fuller on her new memoir, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. Also, Kevin Wilson on his novel, The Family Fang. Plus Joe McGinnis on his aggressive investigation of Sarah Palin. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Andrea Folds, William Miesmer, and Sarah Waltuck. Mayan Levinson was at the audio controls. I'm Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.